When it comes to hiring, don't go searching for the one. Just meet your match with Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/match. Just go to Indeed.com/match right now and support our show by saying you heard about Indeed on this podcast. Indeed.com/match. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/Wondery and use code Wondery for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/Wondery. Code Wondery.
Happy New Year! And welcome to Nerdist Podcast number 302. I hope you guys had a great holiday vacation. Or if you are listening to this way after the holidays, then maybe you recently had a vacation. And so it still sort of works, I guess. Let's not worry about the details. I'm going to be performing stand-up in a lot of cities coming up in the next several months, like in January in Bloomington, Indiana, and Tacoma, Washington, and San Francisco, and then New York in April, and then Madison, Wisconsin, and then Denver, and then Portland and Baltimore and D.C. So go to nerdist.com/calendar to get information on all that stuff. I would like to thank Audible.com for sponsoring this episode of the Nerdist Podcast. If you go to audible.com/nerdist, you can get a free audiobook download. You can just listen to any book. Pretty much any book ever that you could buy is an audiobook on audible.com, which I cannot tell you how valuable audiobooks are, particularly if you live in Los Angeles and you spend a lot of time in your car, or if you commute a lot and you've run out of podcasts to listen to, listen to an audiobook. As a matter of fact, I would recommend Warren Ellis's new book, Gun Machine. Warren is going to be a guest on the podcast very, very, very soon, and he turned out to be a super, super cool guy. I'd never met him. I didn't know. Now I do, and he's great. And Gun Machine is fucking awesome. So check it out, audible.com/nerdist. This episode of the podcast is Tom Morello, who I've known for quite a few years now, and Tom is fucking awesome. And I am going to wager probably out nerds most of you listening to this podcast. And we get into that a bit into the podcast. But we went to Tom's studio in his house and just talked to him for a while. And a lot of stuff I did know, but then a bunch of other stuff I did not know. I did not, for instance, know that Tom Morello is a ridiculously huge Star Trek The Next Generation fan. And we get into that quite a bit. Oh, wee Tom, I should have had you there for this. But anyway, check him out on Twitter. T Morello is his username. At T Morello. M-O-R-E-L-L-O. Also, check out nightwatchmanmusic.com. The Nerdist Podcast number 302 with Tom Morello. Welcome to 2013! It's gonna be the best year ever.
Now entering Nerdist.com.
Chicago.
Almost.
Yeah, it was in Chicago, and
I think that one's already opened by me. You could take this one that is closed.
Do we have to hold these mics?
Yes, thank you for that. Assuming you were very close.
That's
very
it.
Close.
We were going to have you on the we were going to have you on the live show in Chicago.
Yes, that's
and
correct.
It's just like the day just it missed by like
it
just
did,
a
yeah,
day.
Yeah. It's totally fine.
Yeah.
I'm trying to think when's the last time when we crossed paths.
I think
it's been a while.
It might have been at one of Dave Gibbs's Christmas shows at the Hotel Cafe.
Yeah, that sounds right.
I think maybe right around the time you started doing Night Watchman.
Yep. Oh, that's some time ago. Have you seen Dave lately?
I haven't. We've been emailing back and forth, but I haven't seen him in a while.
He does like a classy like Tuesday night thing at a wine bar in Silver Lake, which is a worthwhile society.
Probably check one too. Hello.
Yeah.
Down to business. Yes. Check one too. All right.
He's doing a classy wine bar show?
Not a show. It's just sort of like he's become a wine guy, and they go and they talk about the vintage of grapes.
Good.
Oh, is that the one on
cherry aftertaste?
Is that the place on Glendale?
It's next to the Cha-Cha and Hollywood.
Hollywood.
Kind of east.
Dave Gibbs is an incredible musician, and he was in a band called the Gigolo Ants, who I think had a song on the That Thing You Do soundtrack.
Mm. Yes.
And he also, Dave was the music director for Rock of Ages, so Dave is the guy that I wrote all of those Sniper songs with.
That's
like
right,
all those
we made 80s. The video.
Dave is an incredibly talented guy.
Yeah.
Good guy. And his wife, by the way, is been on every show and every commercial.
And every commercial, yeah. If you turn on a commercial,
Jillian
she's
Bigman.
There.
Yeah. Amazing. Yeah. But we're in your home studio now, which is really, it's really comfortable in here. Like,
yes.
I just want to hang out and record stuff. Yeah. Which I guess is what we're doing.
Exactly. Well, your dream has been realized because we're recording stuff right now.
Do people know how far down the nerd hole it goes for you, or have you kept it?
No. I'm full nerd disclosure.
Okay.
But if we'd like to go through that resume, I'd be happy to.
I just heard a story that when you first started dating your wife, that
yes.
of course then girlfriend at the time,
yeah.
that you you let her think that on like that some night you were going to a strip club when in fact you were actually going to play D&D. Is that a true story?
That's not a true story. I wish that were a
true
story.
I thought Gibbs told me that.
Yeah,
he was like, yeah, he used to play so much and he lied to us because he didn't want her to.
No, she's, yeah, my wife is, for better or worse, much cooler than I am. But she's come to sort of appreciate some of the geekitude. And, you know, she looked forward to the first. We had to do like I lured her in with Lord of the Rings, the books, and
sure.
she didn't want to read. You know, like we start. I thought we're going to start on The Hobbit, honey, because that's like a good entry drug. That's a good entry drug, and we're going to read it out loud together. And we'd read like a page and a half, and she'd fall asleep. And she's like, okay, so let me understand. There's like tots. No, they're hobbits. They're not tots. So finally, after you know, we suffered through The Hobbit, and then we made our way into Lord of the Rings. She reached a tipping point where at one point later she's like, no, we have to keep reading.
Oh,
keep reading.
Good.
Yeah.
I think Led Zeppelin is a good gateway into Tolkien.
Yeah.
Where it's like, just
the nerd snare.
Listen to the Immigrant Song. Yeah. Don't you want to hear more about this battle?
Yeah. Gollum and the evil ones stepped up and slipped away with her. Where does that come from?
I can source that. I can source that material. That's awesome.
That's
so
funny.
Did you play D&D for a while?
Yes, I was a full-on dungeon master in Libertyville, Illinois, and I had the books, and I spent in much of my youth developing. We didn't use like the modules, you know, so
right.
I wanted it all to be from scratch because my scenarios, of course, integrated my social justice agenda.
Of course.
With my Dungeons and with my desire for fantasy orc slaying. and so it was always, the king was always the bad guy.
We're going to slay orcs, but I want everyone to understand that they are equal.
Yeah, exactly.
They're the working class.
Yeah, yes, exactly. They're going to team with the vassals.
So you were a DM, which is a whole different.
Oh yeah,
it's a different shade of D&D player. I never liked DMing myself because I hated. I just wanted to play. I didn't want to have to build a little fort.
Oh,
and
the building
like,
was. Well, I never did like the. It was all. There was never any sort of construction, and we never painted figurines. It was all kind of like mental. But then this one, and then it spun off into the D&D sort of. Suburbs,
mm-hmm.
you know, the villains and vigilantes. Did you ever get into that? Which is like the superhero version. Crime Fighters, which is like the 20s gangster.
I played that, and I played Boot Hill, which was the Western
one. I never did Boot Hill, but then there was one that I. What was the one? It was a post-apocalyptic radiation world, Gamma World.
Okay, I heard of Gamma World.
Yeah, that was another
one
that we spent countless hours doing. So misspent you. And the thing is, like, I did it with it. Like, now I have the feeling that people who maybe engage in magic, I don't know what the latest thing is, magic, whatever the kids play now, is that they realize that it's a geeky endeavor and that because they're playing it, they won't get dates. I did it with complete innocence.
Right.
I thought this is just a thing that I love and it's fun to do, and the fact that I'm not getting dates must be wholly unrelated.
Yeah.
I better get into music.
To these endeavors, yeah.
Well, when we do these shows, there's a lot of kids will ask us, like, oh, when did you know you were like a nerdy guy? And like, and I always tell them, it's like, I didn't think, I thought everything I was doing was awesome.
Yeah.
I never once was embarrassed about it.
It really was a around the time that I met my girlfriend who became my wife. She pointed out these things that, like, that's not okay or normal. And she has, like, a Tourette's. One day we were walking down Ventura Boulevard, and there's a gaming shop there.
Oh, yeah.
We're gaming shop there. And the door is open, and it's, you know, it's the middle of a beautiful afternoon. There's a bunch of, like, boys and grown men in there who engaged in some sort of, you know, there's a table out and some sort of cards and whatnot. And she, you know, we're just having a discussion. Oh, and we just fixed your bike. How's this? She looks in there and, like, her eyes roll back and she just shouts, "Nerds!"
Oh, jeez.
I'm like, whoa! And, like, you know, for them, like a pretty girl walks by and it takes them down, like, 17 notches in their lives. Yeah. I'm like, what's wrong with you? You married one.
Your girlfriend, your wife was in, so she's in the pie house and you were a tri-lamb. Is this what's happening?
She's like, exactly. I aspired to tri-lambdom. They wouldn't let me in there, man.
I think I knew when I was growing up that it was not a quote unquote cool thing to do because I could feel the coldness of being socially ostracized, but I didn't care wanted to do this.
At least that's a choice. I just was blindly enjoying myself. Yeah. Thinking that this was, you know.
Knights and goblins are cool. Can't wait to bring this up at a party I get invited to one day.
Yeah. Oh, like a quarterback could slay a dragon? Yeah. I don't think so. That guy wouldn't last fucking 5 minutes.
Part of it, for me, I was an only child. I am an only child, so that there was no kind of sibling, you know, berating on either, I know, on either end of the scale. So
I can tell you when I did lose self-awareness, though. When I was in college, I was into juggling, and I thought everyone would think that was really cool.
Yeah, juggling. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
They did not.
I worked my way through college working at the Renaissance Fair.
No! Whoa. Fuck it! By the way, you say college
speaking
with
juggling,
a capital C.
I'll juggle all this shit on the table right here, right now.
Let's go back for a minute because you're everything about you is so interesting to me. First of all, I don't know if I could name many Irish, Italian, Kenyans in the world.
That's correct, yeah.
And then you grew up in Illinois, and then you went to Harvard. So when you say college, you worked your way through Harvard at working for
at the Renaissance,
Fair.
That's correct. The Bristol Renaissance Fair in Wisconsin, the King Richard's Fair. And I began for 5 summers. That was my gig. And I started out as an unpaid apprentice because it allowed me to live in the Lord of the Rings world, which when I finished the books, I felt a great loss because I have more adventures. Yeah, there's no more mountains.
A lot of crazy mead parties happening.
There was somewhat of a suspension of disbelief, and that's because it's a beautiful, like the Renaissance Fair here in Southern California is kind of a desert with jousting occurring in it.
It's just like in the rocky, aqueduct or something.
It really felt like you were in, you know, sort of a Sherwood.
So you were an apprentice. When does guitar come in? Were you a lute player?
Later on I became like, I was, you know, sort of playing little Renaissance, playing and writing Renaissance jams and, you know, sort of courting the girls from Kenosha, Wisconsin.
Kenosha! Oh my God, the Cheese Castle! I've been to the Cheese Castle.
And I was an aspiring actor at the time as well. So all of that, you know, I spent 5 summers in tights working, you know, traipsing about the Wisconsin
singing,
wilderness.
Singing, running around the family with a pocket full of shells.
Would ye like another glass of molten metal?
That's fucking awesome. Do you have any video of this? Yeah.
For better or worse, this is like there were barely cave paintings.
Okay, gotcha.
Would the lady like to accompany me to Danzig tonight?
It was a place where you could check, because I grew up in a very conservative small town, an all-white conservative small town. So I went to the Renaissance Fair where it's kind of like hippie free love times. Yeah. Like there's a greater sort of accept, and everyone there is Dungeons and Dragons, you know, has that on their resume. So it felt like sort of more welcoming community. Yeah.
Because I wonder if, you know, for a guy like you that is culturally unique, as well as the stuff that you were into might have put you in a weird category in a totally conservative Illinois town. Yeah, did you ever feel identity crisis-y, or did you sort of like, were you like, no, this is just who I am and what I'm into?
It's only upon reflection that I felt that it was like how sort of singular that existence was. Like, I thought that everyone in Libertyville had pictures of, you know, Che Guevara and Kwame Nkrumah on their walls.
Turns out not the case.
Sure, it turned out that it was not the case, you know, and that, you know, and then my sort of predilection for, I like sports, but I also liked punk rock music, and I liked heavy metal, and I liked Dungeons and Dragons, and, you know, my click there was the drama club kids, not high on the social ladder, but kids that were smart, were creative, and, you know, had a pretty great time, you know, when there was, you know, aside from some of the dramatic racist issues that occurred during my youth.
Really?
Yeah. Like the noose in the garage day. That was a bad
Holy
one.
Who the
shit.
Fuck would do that?
The Klan.
Are you
what?
Serious?
Yeah, yeah. That's what they do. That's one of the things
they got
they
that far north?
Yeah, the deep north, man. It's yeah, I saw more than one noose as a kid growing up.
Oh, Jesus yeah, yeah. Christ.
My mom, who was a history teacher at the same high school that I attended, would occasionally have like Klan literature like posted like on her, like kids would come in and put it up, or they'd tie her, you know, like the little screen thing in a nuisance. It was like, it's crazy. I mean, jeez, there was in some ways, it's a very idyllic, bucolic suburban community where you ride your bike around. It's cool. And then it's also really horrible at the yeah. same
time. Well, who, I mean, time. To a kid, I just don't, I don't even, but from a certain point of view, is there any part of you that weirdly appreciates that you had that experience because now you are so socially active
yeah.
that maybe did that yeah. make
well,
you
that
go
was,
hey
I mean,
there's
that
a lot
was,
of
that was no I mean that was just a purely it was when I was 13 years old, a purely terrifying I went to bed scared to death for years afterwards, you know,
Jesus
like because somebody's
Christ.
In the driveway with a rope that they're going to go in, open your garage door and make a new, and then like that was just so.
And was your mom a single mom?
Yeah,
right?
Single
so
mom.
It was
single
just
mom.
The two
yeah,
of
just
you.
Two of us. Yeah,
Jesus
just two of us.
Christ.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So I mean, that's the other side of the coin. But yeah, I mean, much of my people will often ask like where. You know, what was your political awakening? You know, like what books did you? I'm like, I was the only black kid in all white town. That gets political in kindergarten.
Right, right, right.
You go out on the playground the first time with an afro and politics comes to you. You don't gotta go finding it. Like you're just, I just parachuted in the middle of Mississippi burning. You know,
oh,
it's like, it's
God.
Crazy.
And so, what were some of your early, like, you know, when you grow, because we're close to the same age,
yeah, yeah.
And it's not like, well, I can just go to the internet and go,
right.
you know, find groups.
Right.
So what was it?
Right.
How did you explore, you know, social activism? And how did you?
I had a click of, I mean, well, the politics in my home, as I said, were very, very different than the community I lived in, and that I sort of mistakenly assumed that everyone had this a very progressive worldview like my mom did. My mom remains I'm the second most radical member of the Morello family to this
okay.
day.
Okay.
she will say shit at the dinner table like, oh my gosh, I agree with that.
Take it down a notch.
Yeah, exactly, Mom.
Take it down a notch, and I'm enraged against
yeah,
the
yeah.
machine.
Yeah, exactly. there were a group of kids in my sort of drama club kingdom who were, you know, who ran an underground newspaper, who had a very, you know, like we were very full of ourselves as 16 to 17 year olds, and we're very confident we knew more than the teachers who were teaching us about politics and history, and you know, and we were. We fed off one another's energy in that way, and that we were going to head out beyond Libertyville to change.
And was that punk rock that got you guys into
it? Was in part, it was like the Clash was a big deal for
yeah.
us, you know. But the Clash kind of helped legitimize what we were thinking and doing, you know.
Yeah.
In a way, it was like someone somewhere outside of our community like felt the same way. We're not just this island in the middle of you know cultural
yeah.
you know.
Yeah, I felt the same way where it's like I started feeling like kind of discontent in the classroom and what I was being taught. And
yeah.
then, you know, finding out when you go to like, you know, we listen to punk rock or start getting like, you know, like zines and stuff like that
yeah.
that are telling you like, oh, and there's you realize there's something more, and it kind of makes
right.
you go, oh, this is kind of I'm going to learn the history and the math and the science,
yeah.
but like everything else kind of is bullshit.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
yeah.
The school newspaper was a very big deal because I worked on the paper along with some of my other friends, and they, you know, we had interests and designs in writing about stuff beyond the school. Like the school newspapers always, you know, didn't the football team give it their all this year? And sure,
right.
it was well attended. You know, like that's like the most controversial editorial. Was it well attended or was it super well attended? Those
right.
were two positions. And, you know, when we wanted to write about apartheid and the, you know, sort of the Contra death squads in Central America and the fact that the dean was a dick,
right.
those were things that you could not do in the official channels. And so there was a massive, a very exciting walkout and then a school paper that eventually had, you know, a greater circulation than the regular one. That was like a learning experience.
So you were able to sort of grow.
Yeah, 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 yeah.
To.
And we were like the school tried to set, you know, it was very like there's a feeling of kind of political impotence when you grow up in the suburbs. Like how would you like you read a history is something that occurs in books, not mm-hmm. something that you are. Could be a part of.
Sure.
And from a very 16 to 17 with this newspaper thing, the school said you may not distribute this on campus. And we said, well, we taught them a lesson that there's a thing called the First Amendment. We involved the ACLU, who told the Libertyville Public High School, yes, they can distribute it on campus. And so from, you know, as teenagers, it was kind of fuck you, I won't do what you tell me, and sticking it to the man.
That's great.
And, you
know,
that's really interesting, though, because I don't think, I mean, maybe now, because, you know, the internet can be such a support structure for people.
Yeah.
But at that time, to decide to just do that, and you're like, no, like, I feel like most kids would have gone, well, the grown-ups say I can't do this.
Right,
so I guess
right,
I'm not
right.
Supposed
yeah,
to
we
do
didn't.
This.
We had a strong anti-authoritarian streak from a very early age.
And how funny is it that, you know, in history class, they're teaching you that the founding fathers basically said, hey, you know, we're not going to be oppressed anymore by what you're telling us.
Yeah,
that was fine for them.
But you guys said the dean is a dick.
Yeah, so sit down and shut the fuck up.
The buck stops here.
Yeah. You're not a founding father. I could be.
And then we would return from these, you know, these very sort of militant newspaper rallies, and we're sticking to, and we would go get our 20-sided dice out and, and return to the comforts, to the numbing comforts.
I love that blowing off steam with D&D. But I think that was sort of, you know, I think the earlier point that I was kind of hedging at a little bit with, you know, what people hanging nooses in your garage or coming up against the dean is that not that those are good experiences, but that the resistance does create, there is like a Newtonian thing that happens.
Yeah,
there's an equal and opposite reaction, which ultimately I think is for the greater good. You know, you came up against a dickhead dean and then you made this paper more politically aware.
You can never do anything great in the world unless you have a chip on your shoulder.
I guess that's true.
You can't.
I guess
you
that's true, because if you're happy and content all the time,
whether it's like a, you know, a father figure issue or whether it's you have to have that chip.
I mean, if everyone in Libertyville when you were growing up was really cool and open-minded and, you know, and you'd probably
still
be like, this
is
great.
Yeah, this is great.
Why would this need to change?
Exactly. I would now be running the gaming shop there.
Yeah.
Which does exist. It's fun. It's funny. Like, now it's like, it is Revenge of the Nerds, because in a block and a half from where my mom lived, there is now a gaming shop where you
can.
That's great. So,
welcome to Morello's. Free pen of coke if you buy an action figure.
I walk in there now. I'm like, high fives, everybody. We won.
Have you ever thought about doing that at some point? Just like, I just want to open like a hobby shop or just open like a thing, you know, just like
that'd
a cool.
So funny, man. Though in a while I do have, in my geek passport is well stamped. Like, it is, like when I go to the Comic Cons and stuff, like there's a lot that I don't know about, and you know,
you can't know everything. There's just
it's
too
crazy.
Much.
Like, it's there's all so much, you know, beyond Star Trek.
I mean, they're pop culture cons now.
But you
specifically were, is it, you were doing Orchid for Dark Horse, right?
That's correct. Yeah. We're still in it. We're still on. I'm writing issue 12 after you guys leave later today. Because I'm behind. Because I'm always behind.
This is my
office.
This is it. How do you manage your time between music, family, comics?
Yeah. It is. I have two children, a 3-year-old and a 19-month-old. So it's pretty that I consider my number one job to be present in their lives. So I don't tour like I did before. I mean, the longest I've been away since my first son was born is 3 months, because I just don't like to be away, and it's too crazy to be away.
You say that like it's a short amount of time, but I guess considering what you used to do.
I mean, I used to be home 3 weeks of the year.
Yeah.
You know, and that's, now it's completely flipped.
And then to like get back from that and try to be like emotionally available for your family.
Oh, yeah, and they look, I mean, if you do that, they look different and they have a different vocabulary. It's like, it's just, it's not like my father was not present all my life, so I like make a very concerted effort to be in theirs every day. So anyway, it's part rock and it's part babe, you know, going to baby music class, you know, with a bunch of MILFs, you know, and then it's retreating to here to write the comic and.
Are you watching any of that kid music being like, oh, if you just went to a diminished chord, like you're trying to do, no.
If you could just, I like the problem, it's not really a problem, but the music teachers are aware of my resume, and so sometimes they're like, you know, auditioning a little.
Oh,
bit.
Sure.
Well, that's like, there's the Silver Lake Conservatory of Music. It's at Sunset Junction, and they're like, it's like all like these like kind of aging hipster guys the teachers there. And like, I think Flea is one of
the guys
who
does the fundraising.
But it's funny because you just see the parents waiting for their kids and it's just like, they're like, oh, you're just a bunch of old hipsters.
Did you see when Greg Barrett was doing Black Rattle?
No.
Do you know Greg?
Yeah, of course.
Very well. Greg Barrett did this Black Rattle, which was basically like metal kid songs. So they would take like,
oh, that's fun.
Where is Thumpkin? Where is Thumpkin? Here I am.
Black Rattle.
That's got to be available online somewhere. But it is kind of funny that, you know, you are sort of in this unique position where it's you. You probably just think like, oh, it's a teacher. He's a teacher. Oh no, he probably wants to.
That's right. Yeah.
Maybe
he's
he
got
wants
a demo.
To...
He's got it. I'm sure.
And it's still on cassette.
Yeah. Exactly. Sure.
Single.
He's got it. Sure. He's got
it. It's a little single sleeve.
Yeah. But the, I mean, the thing with like Orchid, it was I was a big comic book fan as well. That was another huge part of my from 5 to 17. I was collecting comic books, and then put it down. Like when I discovered guitar and politics, because of the escapist nature of Hulk fighting Thor just kind of went by the wayside.
Sure.
But then when I had this idea for the story Orchid, this was about four years ago, and I didn't like approach it like I want to write a graphic novel or I want to write a comic. I was just like, I just got a story and I have to figure out how to do it. And I didn't have time to write a 900-page novel in my life, and I didn't want to be a dude knocking on studio doors with a screenplay because that's not a great look.
Right.
You know, that's that doesn't feel like the right direction.
A Rage Against the Machine guy?
Yeah.
Well, that's the other problem is that you come up against, and I think, and Rob Zombie had that a lot when he first started making films, which is what he really wanted to do.
Right.
Is that people compartmentalize you and
that's
they go, no, you're just that guy.
Yeah, exactly.
Like, I'm not just that guy. Yeah. What are you talking about?
Yes. I have feelings and ideas.
And other than
you're the animator, Rob Zombie.
Visions of sword play.
Yeah. Which is the name of his next album.
Visions of sword play. And
yes,
so you with the comic though, is that another form of escapism for you? Is it just
I wanted to combine like my love of the things like Lord of the Rings and Star Wars and stuff like that, but with my worldview, and that to have something that's going to be a thrilling fantasy narrative, but that's also going to have the, the politics of Battle of Algiers or something, and so it's been great. Like for me, it's like really jumping in the deep end because I was not a comic writer beforehand. I was a storyteller my whole life, and sort of kind of Dark Horse have been very helpful in kind of helping me rein in, it's got to be 12 issues and they have to come out once a month. and I also, one of the things that I do in my studio here is I score the comic as well. There's musical score with each issue of the comic that you get for free. So it's like because I've done a lot of film scoring. So I've sort of took those chops and brought them into the world of the comic, and it's super fun to do. Yeah.
So how do you have like a tone where it's like you'll have the music going and it'll be like boom, turn the page, and then you turn the page.
It's not quite that literal. Yeah. It's more vibe, man.
Yeah.
And then at the end of the it's a 12 issue cycle, and then at the end of that there'll be like a 12 song CD.
Oh, cool.
Companies it is the musical score.
That's great.
How was Harvard once you got to Harvard?
How was Harvard? It was challenging because I went to public school, and however I was wired, public school was not a great challenge for me.
Yeah.
And Harvard was.
Yes.
Harvard was no joke, man. It was my first night. I went to my first political science class. I'm like, I'm at Harvard, man. I was not because of any genius on my part. It's very, very preface what I'm about to say. I was the first person from Libertyville to ever go to Harvard. No one else had ever applied.
Doesn't sound surprising to me though, based on what I've heard so far.
No one else had ever
applied. So the new guy didn't apply to Harvard. Weird.
Yeah. So I was like, I'm representing, and I'm here, and I've got the thing, and I'm reading Thomas Paine's The Rights of Man on my first night there, and it feels like this is it, man. I'm on the way, and it's 8 o'clock, and then it's 3:30 in the morning, and I'm about a fourth of the way through the book. I got two more books to read. Oh shit! This is I'm not in Libertyville anymore,
this
man.
Is real.
Yeah, so it was challenging, but I enjoyed it great. I was very glad that I went. It's one of the things that, well, the education there was great. Friends I made there were great. The kind of the intellectual challenge was great. The thing that was I think most important was just leaving home.
Yeah,
like getting that 1,000-mile perspective on where I'm from.
Yeah.
And, I didn't know that I had a hayseed Midwestern accent till I went to Harvard and all those people who talk like,
hey, you talk weird there.
Exactly.
What?
Exactly. It just gave me like a very different perspective on, and I think that's crucial because you can always decide to go back.
Sure.
But you need to know somewhere else. And
you are definitely, to some degree, we are reactive to our environments, and it is important to, I never understood the value of traveling when I was really young. I'm like, why do I need to travel? What do I need to see?
Yeah, yeah.
And then you start traveling, you're like, oh, right. Oh, of course, other cultures, ways of other being exposed to, so that I can grow. Like, it's really important.
Yeah, yeah. My mom, who had no budget as a public high school teacher as a kid, when I was a kid, twice took us to Europe. And just because she wanted to, she wanted me to see, she had traveled the world as a single woman in her from her like 20s to her 40s, just like on steamers and whatnot, and taught in China and Germany, places like that. And that's how she eventually ended up in Kenya, where she met my dad. But so she wanted me to just see the Louvre, and I just fought it, and I squirmed, and I'm like, I don't want to see the Alps. I want to read Watership Down, you know, the back of the car while a beautiful scene. But it really stuck with me, those experiences, and getting a different perspective on Illinois, you know, later on. And then as a touring musician, it resonated so deeply later. A lot of guys and girls in bands who tour the world, you know, go from the gig to their hotel to the party to the next gig.
Right.
And I had the paid vacation of a lifetime exploring the planet, in part because of those seeds that were planted when I was a kid.
What are some places that you love that you would never have thought to go?
Oh, geez. I mean, Reykjavik was one.
I've always wanted to go to Reykjavik.
Yeah, it's why I would awesome. Like, be careful. Like, it is Viking country up there.
Right.
It's a whole different. Outside of the Reykjavik Pizza Hut, nothing will make sense. And the bill there is like $100. I was there in. This is the first place that Rage Against the Machine had a number one record. And they get, at the time, I'm not sure if it's changed now, but they had get very few Western artists there. And so, like, they get two shows a year. And, you know, it's one of them's Brian Adams. And they
and then there's 100 Bjork shows.
And then a Sugar Cubes reunion.
Yeah, and we were.
and then Dancer in the Dark screens.
and at the time, we were opening up for House of Pain and clubs here, you know, and like
really?
Living in a squat. Yeah, like it was the band had no traction anywhere, but we were number one in Iceland. So we're like, we got to go there, man. So we go there, we get off the plane, and there's media, you know, like media. And we're looking like, is Nelson Mandela on this flight or something? But no, it's just because Rage Against the Machine is here. And we're like, all right, that's trippy. And the show is every age bracket, and like everyone in Reykjavik came to the show, you know. And,
wow.
And then we went, it's a slightly off-color story, but we had no experience with fans other than male fans up until that point, because it's Rage Against the Machine.
Yeah.
It's dudes, all that. So we, and our security guard, we never had a security guard before, was literally the strongest man in the world. Like, if you watch ESPN2, the guy pulling the train with his teeth, who was number one, Jans Johansson, whatever his name was our guy.
Wow.
So the strongest man in the world was protecting us. We're like, why do we need it? Why? That's weird. So we go to the after party for the show. You know, it's like 24 hours a day there, so the after party starts at like 2, and we're in a room with a band. I forget what the English translation of their Viking name was. Jet Black Stool.
Okay.
So it's already pretty surreal. We've got like the strongest man in the world guarding the door, partying with Jet Black Stool.
Which I warn you can happen if you take Pepto-Bismol and you're not prepared for that to happen.
That's very true.
And I'm like, dude, I see the guys in my band all the time, and Jet Black Stool, I mean, God bless them, but I don't need to spend another minute with them now.
Sure.
I'm going to go out and see what happens. And the strongest man in the world goes, Glernda Sklernda Flernda Hernda. I'm like, I don't know, bro. I don't know what that is. And he sort of puts a hand on my chest like, don't go. I'm like, but we're here to see Iceland. And so he's like, Glernda Sklernda Flernda Hernda. I'm like, all right, bro. Whatever.
They didn't listen to me. I told them Glernda Hernda.
I walk out the door, and it's really like a saloon scene from a Western porn. like there's fist fights going on. I'm out the door about four steps when a comely Viking lass grabs my machine, rages against my machine.
You can make that joke.
I run back in the room and I go, dudes, Glernda Hernda, Flernda's Learnda. like that's what that means. Oh yeah. So Reykjavik.
Don't go the fuck
out. Exactly.
So they just fucking go off.
During the summer months, because then the rest of the time they're in the dark drinking vodka and committing suicide. Yeah.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
The idea of the juxtaposition of you and House of Pain.
Yeah.
Where you guys are coming up with these like, so you know, socially aware, like there's a lot of history and dates.
Yeah.
And then
jump around.
Yeah. And then jump around.
It's life's rich pageant.
That sounds like getting up and reading Common Sense, the book Common Sense at a NASCAR event.
Right.
Like, before the race, it felt much like that.
It felt much like.
Would you all like to hear the Silence Do Good letters?
But that must have been a common juxtaposition at your shows. Was just like you guys are very socially conscious. cautious and trying to spread this word, but these guys are here to punch people.
Yeah, and I mean, and that's, I mean, the band Rage Against the Machine cast the nets very wide in that regard, because it is music you can certainly punch people to, you know, without the lyrical, without the deep lyrical content. It's aggressive music, and so it went very well with the House of Pain fans.
Yeah,
I guess that's true. It is. It's sort of that. It's sort of the Simpsons thing where it's there's a shiny part of it which one group of people can get, and then there's if you really pay attention, you get these really dense nuggets of information as well.
Yeah, yeah.
And that becomes a thing. So it's hard to like you know, you got to remember not to blame the band for their fans.
Right.
For example, Paul Ryan, vice presidential candidate Paul Ryan, his favorite band is Rage Against the Machine.
Oh, there you go.
Yeah, and then
so you guys must have contributed how many songs to the Romney campaign? A lot of them, right?
But that's like, you know, he's a guy that fucking like works out to P90X and he needs something aggressive to pop on. He's not listening to the lyrics. He's just like going, this is a good fucking beat.
I am yoked, bro.
Dude, your band is the best for crunches.
Yeah, that's right. It is a very good crunch band. It is a very good crunch band.
What is it, you know, with Rage, because I feel like there's so much that you guys are saying musically and you know, and politically, what is it that you want people to take away from that? Because Night Watchman, I feel like, is a little more...
That's correct.
It's a little more specific.
That's correct.
With your specific point.
That's correct. Yeah, it's, you're not... With the Night Watchman stuff, there's less distraction of the huge beats and grooves and whatnot. You know, and that's always been one of the challenges of the band Rage Against the Machine, which, you know, now tours at a very gentlemanly pace of about one show every 2 years, so it's not such an issue these days as it once was. But you know, it was, I mean, different people in the band look at it differently. I always liked the fact that the band cast the nets very wide, and that I hear every day people who were turned onto a new set of ideas because they were drawn to it because of the rock, you know, and that's you know, if you're, I don't know, Fugazi or even the Night Watchman, like that's maybe not the case. People, it's, you're tend to preach to the believers who are drawn to it. With Rage, people were drawn to it who liked, you know, from Twisted Sister to Bad Brains, you know, like that music. Yeah. And then there's a whole different you know, set of lyrics. So I never really had a litmus test, unless you're going to run for vice president and try to stick and try to stick it to 99.9% of Rage Against the Machine fans. Then I will have an opinion about that.
I do remember that. I remember talking to a lot of guys that they cite Rage Against the Machine as the band that like helped them become a little more socially aware. But then also when they, you know, went behind it, and that's what got them into Fugazi.
Sure.
And then they started, you know, that whole thing where, like, you know, Green Day will come out and they'll be like, oh, Lookout Records, and they'll fall into Operation Ivy and go.
That's right.
And Rage Against the Machine was kind of that spike like, you know, the smarter people followed down.
Yeah. I mean, I grew up in a place where there was no indie, there was zero access to any indie anything. Like, I got all of my records at the mall, at a place called Music Land at the mall, and that's where I got my Kiss records, and that's later where I got my Clash records. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, I've never subscribed to sometimes there's an elitism in the world of punk or political music that, you know, you have to be, you know, your fans have to have as cool haircuts as you do, you know? Yeah. And I was just like, no, what you just said, you speak to that. It's like, you could get the Rage Against Machine record at Music Land at the mall, but it opened doors to a lot of other stuff.
Yeah. I guess there is a really interesting balance with, I mean, do you feel like you're creating a relationship with your audience, or, you know, because some people are like, fuck you, man, this is my message and I don't give a shit who, you know, and then other people go, well, you know, if you want to sort of take your very specific idea and make it palatable, like, do you think about that way at all, or do you just make what you want to make?
I think first and foremost, whether it's with Rage Against the Machine or the Night Watchman or even Orchid the Comic Book, like, the art has to be good, you know, like, it's, otherwise it can't just be, you know, a Noam Chomsky lecture set to a beat. You know, it has to.
Unless it's auto-tuned. Then you can
do it. And I'm sure that's out there.
Yeah, that could,
that probably
that could,
is out
it
there.
Could very well be. But, you know, first and foremost, like, it has to be, like, I didn't really choose to play guitar. That kind of chose me and felt like a calling. So given that straitjacket of vocation, then to sort of find a way to make great guitar music that also expresses the worldview, and then you let the chips fall where they may. Like, I was in a band before Rage Against the Machine called Lockup that had much greater commercial aspiration. Like, it was a band that wanted to be signed and a band that wanted to have videos and whatnot. And, you know, and every sort of record company dicking cliche imaginable happened to that band, and I was done. I was like, I was gonna be a musician, but I missed my chance at the brass ring.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when Rage Against the Machine formed, in part because, like, my new way of looking at the world was, I'm just going to play music I love.
Yeah.
I'm just going to, you know. And there was no, at the time, let me tell you, in 1991 when that band formed, there were no multi-ethnic neo-Marxist rock rap bands on K-Rock. So it wasn't exactly a formula for success. Yeah. Like, here's the, let's put together the thing that's going to
Living Color
to
didn't really.
Yeah. Living Color kicked down some doors, but not all those.
Not all those doors.
Do you, what was like your guys' like scene? Like when you got together, were you just playing like house shows and like
well,
small
we got
bars?
We came out of the womb pretty well formed. Like the we wrote and did a demo tape, which had the majority of the songs on the first record on it before we played our show.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And so the idea was that we were going to sort of get to, the idea was to sort of make a record or a cassette that was just going to be the proud work that we did, you know?
Yeah.
And then we didn't, honestly, there wasn't even a deluded belief that we'd be able to book club shows because there were not clubs that booked rap. There were not rock clubs that booked rappers, you know, and there just was no place for it. And so we started out, the first time we ever performed in public or in front of anyone was a house party in Huntington Beach because Tim and Zach were part of like sort of the punk rock.
The Revelation
there.
Records.
Yeah. And so the parents were away and we played, we had five songs and the first song we ever played in front of people was a song called Take the Power Back. And, you know, and I had been in bands that people liked the bands, people didn't like the band. And from when the beat dropped in Take the Power Back, there was a huge pit in the living room, like within 10 seconds of the music beginning, I thought, well, this might be a different situation.
You could feel it right away.
Yeah, it was people went ape shit from day one for that band.
Do you think that's the key? Because you know, in any artistic endeavor, whether it's comedy or writing or painting or music, whatever, you know, the important thing is to sort of. It's that moment where you figure out your voice or you start to feel like, oh, fuck, I think this is who I am.
Yeah,
really cool. Is that, you know, do you think that what has to happen is. It's like your experience of, I tried the traditional route, that didn't work, and it forced me to look inward.
That's correct. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I don't know that the biggest songs in the world from Rihanna or Taylor Swift subscribe to that, but certainly in the art that I'm most drawn to, it seems to be, it's honest. You know, and that's the thing that I sort of divorced. And since then, I've followed that, like whether it's with Rage Against the Machine Records that would sell 10 million copies or Night Watchman Records that would sell 1,000 copies or the comic book. It's like I just do stuff that feels real to me, and then you'd let the chips fall where they may. And I think that's what initially drew people to Rage. It was just like, oh my gosh, it's like it's so great. Like, how dare they?
And especially when you look at what you guys were doing, it seems like there's this consistent pattern of you sort of being out of place in a situation,
correct.
Kind of redefining what that means, and making it okay.
Yeah. I mean, I was the only black kid in all white town. I was the only anarchist in a conservative high school. I was the only person who was committed to a career in rock and roll at Harvard University. And I was the only Harvard dude in a rock band, you know, like trying, you know.
Yeah.
So it's, you know, and then it just like, it's my first solo album was named One Man Revolution for a reason, you know.
Do you feel that how do you feel the education system is now for people? I mean, like those are such disparate, going from public school to an institution like Harvard. Obviously you said it was academically it was more challenging than you thought it would, but you know, is that just sort of the state now, is it that people are not prepared? Do we even need to go to college anymore?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, as my children are now entering the California education system, it's pretty crazy. And like the public school that I went to is better outfitted than the best private school in Los Angeles. You know, I mean, just like, because, I don't know whether it's because suburbs have more money, but like when I look at LA Unified, it's brutal. It's like, you know, they don't have PE, they don't have art, they don't have music, they don't have hot lunch. It's like the disadvantage that kids are at going to public school. It's like, it's pretty crazy. I was committed that my kids are going to public school until I looked at the public school. like, oh my gosh, you know, you don't have books for just second graders. Like,
send my kids to a SUNY private school, but I want them to learn stuff.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. May they have books?
Can you feed them?
May they have books? Once a day,
just let them run around outside.
And that's a matter. I mean, that speaks to like a core of a lot of my work. It's like the grotesque misappropriation of resources and the skewed priorities of what our society.
There's a proposition out in California for that right now, isn't there?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, and while propositions can sort of tweak the system, for me, the bigger picture is the people that own and control the country and the world don't deserve to. And right. they do it in their own interest and not in the interest of the betterment of the planet. Yeah. And so that's, you know, that's what my songs, that's what my guitar solos, that's what my comic books tend to be about.
But at this point, do you feel, well, first of all, I want to say two things. Number one, I hate propositions because they're always worded in a way where you're like,
sneaky.
Am I for this thing or
sneaky.
Against this thing?
Super
the way they worded it seems like both. Each
it does
both.
Like, yeah. Wait, I don't know. I, you know.
Because if, heaven forbid, a good proposition to do good in the world came on the ballot, then there'd be six corporate-sponsored propositions similarly worded that did the opposite in order to obfuscate the what's really
oh that's
on.
Interesting that reminds me of something that I read about you, and then I want to ask you a question about big government as a whole, but the that you worked for a senator for a while and you said a woman called in and she was complaining about Mexicans moving into her neighborhood and you called her a racist, and then you got in trouble and you're like, I don't want to work somewhere where I can't call a racist a racist.
That's correct. Yeah, I was a scheduling secretary for U.S. Senator Alan Cranston for 2 years, and it was an eye-opener. It wasn't that I was trying to go into the world of electoral politics. It was a day. It was a job that my heart. On my work resume, I had the Renaissance Fair. On my educational resume, I had Harvard. When I moved, I couldn't get hired selling heavy Iron Maiden T-shirts on Hollywood Boulevard. Like, I didn't have that. I could juggle. Like, if you need someone to juggle
T-shirts, special skills are business and sword making.
Exactly.
That's a job you can get on Hollywood Boulevard.
Yeah. Do you need someone to fence? I can do that.
I can go in at the courts. You fence in the courts now, right?
Yeah, fences. No.
So anyway, that's what got me placed at the senator's office. But it was very eye opening and like sort of while Alan Cranston is several degrees more progressive than President Obama. It just taught me, like, it's not for me. It's like, it's so compromised. I mean, the senator, God rest his soul, was like a really good dude. He spent all his time asking rich guys for money.
Yeah.
All his time. And none of that money comes for free. But the icing on the cake was what you mentioned was, like, this lady calls up and she's her message to the senator, and she wants something done about it, is there's Mexicans moving into her neighborhood. Mm-hmm. And I listened to her and I said, ma'am, you're a racist and you can go to hell. And I'm thinking, I have high five, senator. High five.
I did good.
I represented
you
the
do
day.
Not talk to the constituents. It's almost like them. Like
I got yelled at for 2 weeks by like everybody up and down the ladder, and I thought, well, this may not be the place.
Politicians are basically like Mike Judge's character in Office Space.
Yeah.
It's maybe not the place for me.
It's a bummer, but I wonder. I wonder with big government, and I, is it even possible anymore? Because there are so many people, so many corporations, so many interests, so many different sides trying to vie for their little piece.
Yeah.
Is it even possible to run a country this big anymore? I don't know.
Well, I mean, I think that both. I mean, clearly from my personal experience with the progressive senator just going for the big money and the Republican side, that's what they thrive on. It's the deck is stacked, and it's like I said, the people that run the country don't deserve to. And whether it's a Democrat or Republican in office, while there are important shades of difference, which can mean life or death to people with regards to foreign policy and the lights on or off with regards to poor people here in the country, that both sides are beholden to the same ruling class interest. That's my view. And that's why I've always my efforts have always been aimed at not getting the right person in office. It's getting the right critical mass from below to really make substantive change. Because anything, in my view, any good radical progressive change that's happened in this country has come from below. Like, whether it's lunch counters being desegregated, women getting the right to vote. If you look around, like the Berlin Wall falling, apartheid ending, all those things happened because of people. Just regular people fought for that. And then eventually the powers that be had to come around.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. Even if you had, whoever the ideal candidate would be, like, this is the perfect candidate, you put them into the structure of politics. I still don't know if they're going to be able to do. I think they would get there and be like, oh, fuck, I can't get anything done because there's too many sides opposing everything.
You even see that with the any GOP candidate. When they start like they seem like when there's like the broad, you know, candidates for the Republican spot, like, you know, they seem all right. And then like, but if they become the guy, then they like John McCain like becomes a completely different guy when he's running for office. Yeah. He was like, I remember seeing him on like The Daily Show. I'd be like, man, for a Republican,
seemed reasonable, like a reasonable a guy that if he was sitting in the room with you, like, well, I may disagree with some of that, but you seem like,
yeah, you're a good dude. You're smart and you can make me laugh because he's a funny guy, too. Yeah, yeah. And then like it happened both times when he saw it in sight, he just became this like, oh, this is am I precious, you know? It just became and that's what I think the GOP does. And then they're like, they just go, right, now you're this guy, this is what you are, and you want it, right? And they're
I think that's just big politics in general. I don't like the idea of partisanship. I don't like it because I feel like, well, I want to be able to, you know, like I want to be able to make my own thing that serves everyone the best. And, you know, some of that side is great, but then those parts aren't good. And some of that side, like, why do you have to pick a side?
Right,
like, why can't we?
Right, right. Well, I mean, and it's something that's unique to the United States and other countries where they have multiple political parties where you actually get to vote for someone who really thinks like you do, and then you get sort of proportionate representation, and then they all figure it out together. Whereas, like, I'm just, oh, it's, you know, it's not the lesser of two evils, it's the evil of two lessers, is what we
are. Oh, well played. Well played.
I didn't just make that up.
Do you think it's more important to like start locally though when it comes to politics? Is that the difference, like in one's own lifetime and what they're able to change? Is it the
I think that first you have to realize, you're sort of going back to like the high school newspaper thing, is that history is not something that happened. History is something that you make, whether with your indifference and passivity and you stand on the sidelines and you let other people do it who have the will to do it, or you engage and you have real, like what all my stuff is about is that you have your hands on the wheel of history, you know, and that history is about people like the people listening to your show who stand up in their place and time to make the world different than it is, or they sit back and they let somebody else do it and then they can't complain.
Right.
Yeah.
I always especially lately, I feel like even saying the word politics, like you could just see the hairs on people's necks
I feel like
we spend so much time trying to tell other people why they're wrong.
Yeah, yeah.
Rather than let's just try to fix things, you know, so even the couple times that, because we never really talk about politics on the show, I don't really like talking about it because I just feel like it divides people in ways that you don't intend, and then they just get mad and they make it all about that.
Right.
And that's not, and no one's going to agree. Like, biologically, we're designed to argue our own points, whether or not it's true is irrelevant. We just have to convince people that what we're saying is right.
Right.
And I hate getting into that shit, but I do feel like, you know, it's just one of those topics that people just why can we not just sit down and go, let's just talk about it.
Yeah.
You're smart.
Yeah.
We don't have to attack each other. Why can't we fix the problem instead of trying to rip each other's fingers off?
It's that feeling where, like, you know, like that initial feeling when you're like first interacting with someone that doesn't speak any English and you don't speak any of their language and they're trying to like ask you directions. You're like, you're so dumb. It's the fucking, you take a right.
I don't care if you're a doctor in your own country. Yeah. You don't know how to get to that store.
This idiot doesn't know where the CVS is.
I don't know what it is. But the whole idea of it just, you know, I don't know. I feel like people want to be mad now more than they want to solve problems.
Yeah. If only they'd work it out like they do on Star Trek The Next Generation.
I mean,
really?
Seriously.
Yeah.
Well, the United Federation of Planets at that point. See, this is where Matt Myra, one of the other guy on the show, Matt Myra, is a huge Next Generation fan, and he's also a huge guitar nerd. So he's my kind of guy.
He submitted a list of questions.
He's bummed out that he couldn't make it.
Well, Matt's working on the Attack of the Show on G4, and Attack, it's sort of funny. Attack is in its death rattle right now. Mm. It's like it's got about 2 months left, and then G4 is going away. Mm. But Matt still has to go in and work every day, and they're working knowing that this is going to end in a few weeks. Yeah. So he was crushed that he couldn't be here today, but he's got to write, getting paid to go through the motions. So he wants to know your favorite guitar.
My favorite guitar, favorite sort of my one favorite guitar would be my Arm the Homeless guitar that I've played throughout for the last 20 some years.
What kind of a
it's sort of a homemade. I had it professionally made at a guitar shop and paid a lot of money for it, and everything about it was horrendous. And it was the worst guitar that anyone had ever seen or played. And through the years, I just replaced everything about it except for the piece of wood that it was.
Was it like the car that Homer designed in The Simpsons? It was like, it's got a cup holder.
Yeah.
Mega horn.
It was separate thing for the kids.
It was like when I got my I was making $13,000 a year at the center's office, and I got my first couple checks, and I put them to, like, I went to a custom design shop. I'm not a luthier, which is you call people who make guitars. Like, but I thought, I need a rosewood fingerboard, and I need a this kind of. I'm like, I don't know. How I've seen guitars in magazines,
can
and
this I play
the same one my whole life. So I made a really shitty guitar, and then changed it through the years, and eventually became the one that I've used for everything.
That's great.
So, okay, so favorite pickups.
Jeez, this is like, the wormhole of nerd world for guitarists is perhaps even deeper.
Okay, we have a question on Twitter.
I'd say ones on there.
At Malmsteen wants to know.
Yeah.
Headbucket wants to.
Okay, the arpeggios you use on the bridge, all of a sudden you just hear everybody turning it.
Oh, a friend of mine, do you know Andrew Goldenhurst, right?
Yep.
Andrew Goldenhurst is a friend of ours who is one of the best magicians. I just saw him at the Magic Castle. He's amazing. But also, not surprisingly, you know, he has these long magician fingers. He's an unbelievable guitarist. Mm. And he plays this stuff by this guy named Michael Hedges.
I'm familiar with Michael
Hedges. And Michael Hedges, I can digest some of it, but I clearly don't have the guitar nerd brain to be like, I can't even process some of this.
Why is that awesome?
Yeah. He's like, playing it up on the neck.
Sometimes it's math.
It is. It's math. That's right. So what pickup?
What pickup? The EMG pickups that are on that guitar. But I want just to, so that he doesn't go and buy this stuff.
Okay.
It is my view that the kind of guitar you have, the kind of pickups, the kind of strings, the kind of amplifier you have, make no difference whatsoever with regards to the how good the music is you make.
You know what? You don't tell Matt that because when Matt gets depressed, he buys guitars.
I mean, it may be guitars may serve to ameliorate your depression.
It could,
but that's a different thing.
I went to his place once. I was like, when's the last time you played that one? He's like, oh, I remember that one.
Well, he's a lefty. He's a lefty, and so he's had he's, you know, he always has, whenever he sees a left-handed guitar.
Right, let's get his questions out of the way.
What else you got? And he also wants to know, what has anyone ever asked you about guitar stuff before? I'm just curious.
It's my tribe, you know, it's fine. Let's just click through these quickly.
So I have a couple of guitar questions for you.
Oh my gosh.
What scale or riff do you play when you first pick up a guitar?
This is unbearable. it's unbearable.
He's still not Myra, even though he's not here.
This is just unbearable. It doesn't matter what riff. I don't know. I don't play riffs. I play a
way.
A minor chord there. I'm sure that's so uninteresting to him.
That's so fucking funny.
Yeah.
I love, there's a really good.
Trying to plug the leak.
Yeah.
A minor. Okay, what else?
There's a really good interview of like this like drumming website tried to do with like, or some show where like they were talking to Dave Grohl about drumming. And they're like, when you were doing the fill for this song, what was your thought process? And he was like, oh, I was just in my head going, modern drummer cover, modern drummer. Modern drummer cover.
Well, I guess you know what that actually is a bigger question is that when you're in the position where that you've been, which is you know you're one of the best guitar players the humans have to offer, how do you stay passionate about that thing and not get like, oh, I don't want to tire my guitar.
It's fine. I mean, I really do look at the guitar. I'm being funny with you, but like I do consider guitar players one of my beloved tribes. You know,
yes.
It's like it's the one that I grew up in. And when I was practicing 8 hours a day, I was reading guitar. I was wishing that I could ask Randy Rhoads and Eddie Van Halen the same questions that I'm being asked now. So I shouldn't be mean.
You're not though, because
you shouldn't be mean to that nice guy.
No.
He's not that nice.
I think the message to take away from that is don't worry so much about all of that shit.
Yeah.
Just like make the thing. Just start making the thing.
Here's if he wants to, he's sort of stuck in the minute. Here's the forest, not the trees answer for it. Is that this guitar that he's asking about, which is my favorite one, it was. it was horrible. And then I tried to make it sound great, and I was unable to. And I switched the neck 10 times and the pickups 10 times and the strings and the put little pieces of dead weight on it to give it more tone, this and that. And it never sounded good to me. And I had this amp, too, that I was just, like, frustrated with. So one day I went in there, and I just – I spent hours fiddling and finally gave up. And I marked the – I got it as good as I could sound. I was not satisfied with it. It was not the tone I wanted. I marked the amplifier, like, this is the best that I can do, and it's not what I want. This is the guitar. And I decided I'm never going to think about it again. I'm going to use this sound and this guitar to now make music. And whatever this sound is the sound that became the sound of Rage Against the Machine records and Audioslave records and Night Watchman records and jamming with Bruce Springsteen records. And I just, like, put it out of my head. Like, I'm not going to chase gear. I'm not going to chase that stuff. Like, that's going to be locked in stone, and now it's just going to be about creating with whatever I've got.
Wow. The, see, again, that is the same message that when you started Rage Against the Machine and you had tried to engineer success before, you tried to engineer a thing, at a certain point, you just got to fucking let shit go and just start making something.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Because you're going to be really, I mean, a lot of guitar players, you see, sometimes Rage in the early days, we would tour with, and my gear, like that amp sitting right there, see the one with like the hood over it, the second one, with like the pane on the side? That's the amp. It's, you can see it. If you take the thing off, you can, it's got like the knob markings are from that day in 1989.
Oh, that's awesome.
That are on that amp head right there that I've used those for every show, every song, every recording.
Are you superstitious about that stuff when you travel a little bit with it? Or are you like,
No, not so much.
Really?
Not so much. Not so much.
I wish I could be like that.
What happens if that amp gets damaged or stolen? Kind of like when Sonic Youth equipment was just stolen, and they're like, there was a bunch of stuff that was made specifically for specific songs, and now it's gone.
It would be bad, but it's not, I'm not. Like, I used to not have any gear attachment, but now I feel a little nostalgic about like a couple of the guitars that have been the main ones because I think that, you know, long after I'm dead, they'll be moldering in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame. And that'll be sort of sad.
They'll have to create lore.
Let's enjoy it now.
Tom Morello couldn't eat breakfast unless this amp was sitting at the table with him.
Yeah, yeah. Let's enjoy it now.
And I'm sure if it did break, you lost it. There's probably like a pod now that you could just like Rage Against the Machine, Tom Morello style.
Where do you, you know, when you talk about playing with guys like Springsteen, or you know, like, first of all, is there anyone that has unnerved you a little bit where you're like, oh, I'm nerding out too much, I can't?
Oh, yeah. I mean, Bruce Springsteen is, he's been a friend for some years now, but I will never consider him a peer. Like, he's the only friend of mine to which I subscribe to a fanzine about, you know?
Right. That's really funny. Hey, Bruce, I heard you're playing with Tom Morello. Oh, shit, that's me.
Yeah, I'm on the chat boards and whatnot, you know? Like, oh, what was the set list tonight in Barcelona? Oh, like, oh really? Man. He played Rosalita in that slot rather than in that slot?
Oh, shit. Oh, come on, Tom, I don't know, man. I just pick up a guitar and play in A minor.
So that one, it's always a great honor when I get to play with them, but it's something that is always still very, very surreal, and I can't really wrap my head around.
It is kind of it's nice to know that you're still a fan. It's nice to know. I think you have
super
to be
super fan. Yeah.
Is there anyone now, like, who are you liking now? Like, do you still find time to?
I don't have as much time. My ear is not quite to the streets like it once was with my, you know, the music I listen to most is in my toddler's music class.
Sure.
Eensy Beansy Spider is one of the hot jams going around these days. But I mean, groups over the course of the last I like Black Keys a lot. I like Arcade Fire a lot. I like Conor Oberst in all of his incarnations a lot. As far as I know, tonight I'm going to go see Leonard Cohen, who I still love, at the Nokia.
Oh,
Nokia,
nice. Yeah. That's going to be a great place for him.
Yeah, I saw him there a few years ago. It was my show of the year. Like, he's just awesome. And at 70, whatever, he made a great record this last year.
At what point, and, you know, maybe this is just something that you learned from having to grow up in ostensibly an adverse environment, mm-hmm. of, like, pulling the confidence to, like, oh, yeah, I deserve to be up here with Springsteen. Like, I mean, obviously you do, but sometimes when people are in that position, how do you not sabotage, I guess?
Yeah. Well, one thing I've been blessed with is a tremendous sense of false confidence ever since I was a kid.
You probably had to survive.
Yeah. I mean, and part of it was like, I was the only kid, like, this is my Psych 101 reading of it. I was the only, my mom and her brother and sister, I was the only child of the next generation. You know, so I got a lot of attention. Yeah. You know, and I was always like people liked me as a kid and I was supported as a kid. So from at the first junior high dance that ever had, the first dude to ask a girl to dance who crossed that no man's land was me.
Oh,
you know, like it was terrifying.
Did she dance with you?
She was freaked out. She did dance with me, but it didn't blossom into romance because I was still the black guy.
That's probably what
she's got a dad.
That was probably
she didn't know you were in.
And that's why a lot of the resentment
to make the dads mad, but that was not that.
A lot of the resentment from the white kids is like, yeah, of course he's able to walk over there.
No, but so that is there's something in me that I've always felt like I'm gonna step out the door and do it, man. Like that's, I don't know where that comes. Probably my mom. Like my mom was, like I said, she grew up in a small coal mining town in central Illinois from which no one had ever left, and she, as a single woman in her 20s, went around the world.
Yeah.
And so there's part of that. So
because
she lives upstairs here, by the way.
Oh, really?
She often when she hears activity, she may appear at some point.
Oh, three generations.
Like we could podcast your mom for like an hour.
Yeah. She's quite a one.
But I do think that just the idea of, you know, the fact that you're confident, but it's not like, hey, I gotta fucking put my chest in your face. Yeah, you know, it's just like there's that sort of quiet confidence that I feel like is something that's good to strive for, which is really just about being comfortable with who you are and knowing that, hey, if I step up to a thing, I'm not going to break the world.
It's
everything's going to be okay.
Right. Wayne Kramer, who's a good friend of mine, the guitar player from the MC5, he's taught me some valuable... Wayne Kramer doesn't often offer advice, but when he does, you'd better listen because it's really good advice. And one thing he said, this was when I was beginning my Night Watchman stuff, and I was very nervous. I was very confident playing in arenas and stadiums, playing electric guitar with Rage and Audioslave, but singing in front of a room of 20 people was pretty nerve-wracking at first. And Wayne and I were playing some benefit show somewhere, and it was very under-rehearsed what we were going to do, and I was backstage kvetching and going like, what? We got it. We're not ready. And Wayne, you know, very, very calmly said, what's the worst thing that's going to happen? Are the bad performance police going to come around and drag us off to jail? Like, you're right. Let's go rock it. It's going to be fine.
He did an in-store at the record store I was working at in Venice once, and he was just like eating pizza, and the guy, another guy who worked there, was a bass player for the Muffs, Ronnie Barnett, and he is Wayne Kramer was eating a piece of pizza. He's like, Wayne, you're gonna eat before you perform? He's all, it's a record store, Ronnie. It's gonna be all right.
Yeah, it's probably gonna work out.
But it is more like, you know, you can perform for thousands of people, and at a certain point, they're sort of faceless in the sense you can't really see people.
Yeah.
So it's sort of like, well, they're just a mass. They're just a throbbing mass, and hopefully I'll connect with them and it'll work out. But yeah, it's like you said, when it's just you, basically there's not that much difference from a guy who just gets up in a room and starts talking, and you can see their faces, and you're super connected.
That's right.
Yeah.
And also it helped with both Rage and Audioslave that you get up there, and if you play these 12 songs, unless you all fall off the stage, it's going to go great. Because
those people came to see those 12
songs. You can't
really,
like, if my guitar snapped in half, it probably would still be okay because those guys sound pretty good, you know. Yeah.
You are comfortable with that, having that relationship with your audience. You're like, I know what you want to see. I'll give you the stuff you want to see.
I mean, it helps with Rage Against the Machine, where there's about, you know, 16 songs in the entire catalog. It's not a lot of records there, man. They're really good songs, but they're not a lot of them.
You just reminded me of how, and just even though I don't know you that well, I knew you enough to know that you're a really sweet guy. Is just the thing that happened at Coachella with Crowded House. Was that you guys where you played?
Oh, yeah. Oh,
and then I think, did Crowded House go first?
I'm not sure. It was just
Crowded House and Rage were programmed around each other.
This was the first Rage Against the Machine show in 7 years in our hometown at the Coachella Festival. There was some anticipation.
Yes. People were very excited. Now, if you come from sort of my world, you know, Neil Finn is an incredible songwriter. I love Crowded House. I love everything they've ever done. I loved all of his solo stuff. Crowded House kind of coming back together was a very big deal. You know, their drummer committed suicide a few years back, and so it was sort of a big...
And they got a bad slot.
They got a bad slot, and so it was Crowded House, you know, and Neil Finn coming out in suits and playing, you know, lovely Crowded House melodies to Rage fans who were really eager to see Rage.
They were just getting their spot.
And I think I think you had made some public statement about how you just felt awful, and I knew that you really did.
I like that guy, and it's, I mean, but that's not... I mean, you got to blame like his management or something. Like somebody, that's not his fault, but that's somebody's fault for putting them. You know, they should have put, you know, Testament there. Somebody could like take the punches. And
Yeah, that was I guess if you're putting a festival together, you're like, oh my god, we got credit, we got Rage Against Me. You know what? Everyone's here for the
fine.
It's gonna be
fine. Let's enjoy ourselves. Yeah.
It would have been better to have like a real combative band. Like if like Jesus Lizard played before.
Sure. They could at least vomit something.
Yeah.
We could do sack tricks or something. You know, to just show them the business. Oh yeah, you want Rage?
Yeah.
Rage exactly. My pants.
Amy Mann is opening for Dimmu Borgir or whatever crazy. It's like I remember Posehn showed me them a couple 5 or 6 years ago. He's like, "This is the most metal band I've ever seen." Like their whole video is just like Satan head stomping on goats, and you know. It's like,
I went to the Guar show last night.
Oh, really?
I haven't seen it.
Is still pounding the board.
Yeah, right? And it's
Richmond,
such a
Virginia's
funny,
own.
Dude, I didn't know that's where they're from because I always thought they were from Florida,
Richmond,
like a lot of metal.
Richmond,
because it's the sunniest state. But there was a guy behind me. Like losing his voice, going Richmond, Virginia, the entire time. Yeah. I was trying to avoid the shaved head guy with the Slayer back tattoo.
Wow.
Yeah,
Guar was a contemporary of Lock Up, my pre Rage Against the Machine.
No way.
Yeah, we were playing a show in Virginia, and I remember looking out at the whatever dim club we were playing, whatever career ending club we were playing in on that particular day, and looking out the window, and their warehouse was across the street. You could see all like the props.
Oh,
the
nice!
I was like, wow, Guar's.
That's awesome.
But now I would be remiss. This is like sort of a sharp turn, but since we're on the nerds, we have to at least spend some time about talking about me being in Star Trek.
Okay.
Because, like, I mean, it's Nerdist and all. And, like, I want to make sure that stamp goes in the
pack. You get your cred.
Well, when you have people that do a lot of. So you were in Star Trek, is it?
Yeah, that's correct.
Because when you have people on that have done a million things, it's like you get so. You go down the rabbit hole and you're like, oh, fuck. Like, when we had Tom Hanks on, someone was like, you didn't ask about Monsters and Mazes. And I'm like, I forgot.
Yeah, Monsters and Mazes.
We didn't ask about a lot of things.
Yeah. We did talk about a lot of things.
I'm familiar with my work in the movie Insurrection as a sonar. Now, admittedly, you might need a laser pointer to find me in the crowd of evil sonar, but that was pretty awesome.
Let's talk a little bit about Star Trek. So you referenced Next Gen earlier. Are you a classic Star Trek fan?
Those are the two, and it's hard, it's like which of your children do you prefer? It's hard to. I mean, right. I love Kirk punches a dude or gets with a space alien. I love that. But Next Generation was the one when I was spending a lot of time unemployed on the couch watching those reruns again and again and again. So that's wormed its way into my psyche in a way that I really love it.
And so how did the Star Trek cameo happen?
Yes, the producer of Star Trek's son happened to be a Rage Against the Machine fan and came to me, like they came at me for something and we were in like some...
Do you mean Rod Roddenberry?
No, the next...
Oh, of Next Gen.
Yeah, of Next Gen. Rick Berman's son was a Rage fan. And somehow we were in some, like, touch football thing, and we just started talking about what we did for a living, and I was like, you don't understand. Like, I'll sign all Rage Against the Machine shit you want for your kid. I'll bring him to rehearsal. He can ride piggyback on me while I play a show. I want to be in some Star Trek. And they're like, sure, no problem. So, like, I got, like, the full Paramount Pictures. At the time, all the sets were up, you know. Yeah. Like, they were still doing the show. So all of, you know, the tour of the new and the old, and I'm sitting in the captain's chair, just pretty awesome. And then I was in the movie Insurrection. But it was fun to be in the movie, but I got to hang out for a couple days on set with my Star Trek heroes. And at the time, like, they were really neck and neck with Bruce Springsteen. Like, Jean-Luc Picard, like, as far as nervous to meet. And so I'm there with, you know, the people who are in the Sona makeup. And this was an hour and 45 minutes drive outside of L.A., somewhere in the middle of nowhere. And I'm cheery at 4 a.m. when my makeup starts, you know. And I'm there with the other people who are getting their makeup. I'm like, and for them, it's the worst gig they've ever had in their lives. Oh, I got, you know, I just left Granada Hills and I got to be up here. I'm like, all right, guys, what an awesome day of work this is.
You know what cracks me about that is that
you win a contest.
Yeah, exactly. You're like, this is so great. And they're like, oh, what do you do? And you go, I'm a musician. And they're like, well, hopefully that'll work out.
Yeah.
You're doing this extra work until
much,
then.
Much of the day anonymously, and so I'm fully geared up in my Sona suit by 6:30 in the morning, and the cast begins arriving. I'm so excited, and Rick Berman's become a friend of mine. He's really nice, and so introduces me. And Jean-Luc Picard had received like a briefing on me on his drive up because he's like, so there's going to be someone here today. He didn't know much about the band. He's very interested in sort of
a band that was successful but had these particular politics. So he went, we had a nice chat, and I'm losing my mind. And so then the day proceeds, and it's, you know, it's very fun for me, not less so for my other Sona actors. And they're tripping because, like, throughout the day, members of the cast and, like, directors and stuff are coming up and paying a lot of attention to one particular extra, me, and they're like, you know, they're sitting down. Yeah. I was like, hey, how's it going? Like, what's up, dude? Like, are you related to something?
You got,
like,
it.
I don't know. I don't know. Like, yeah. Yeah. I wear the makeup well.
Yeah. I've seen a lot of Sona come through here, but this one guy, he just has it down.
And so around the time, like, their lunch break or dinner break, like, word had finally gotten around. And then the rest of they got a little bit uncomfortable because all of my Sona mates, they were all in bands, and they all had demos in the car,
shit.
And they all were, and the rest of the day was kind of brutal because everybody was like, you know,
that sucks.
That's pretty exciting. You know what?
I was in Voyager as well.
Hey,
speaking role, episode The Good Shepherd.
Speaking role, an under five, if you will.
Under five,
SAG card.
Voyager. This episode is brought to you by the effortlessly scrumptious bite of Skinny Pop popcorn. Imagine this: perfectly popped, endlessly delicious kernels. A symphony of just three simple ingredients: popcorn, sunflower oil, and a sprinkle of salt. No compromise, just pure snacking freedom. And hey, if you're up for a twist, dive into flavors like zesty white cheddar to sweet and salty kettle. Every bite's a delight, light and oh so tasty. Shop Skinny Pop now.